The court will proceed to the third case, Continental Casualty versus Northwestern National. Mr. Smoke.
May it please the court. My name is Evan Smoke, and I'm counsel for Northwestern National Insurance Company. The district court committed reversible error by ignoring evidence, including CNA's own admissions, that raised a reasonable inference on a material issue in favor of NNIC as the non-moving party. Compounding that error, the district court gave CNA, as the moving party, the benefit of multiple inferences. This morning, I want to focus on three CNA admissions that lead to a reasonable inference in favor of NNIC's position and that compel reversal of summary judgment. The first CNA admission involves CNA's application of the $6.1 million commutation payment to a CIC facultative certificate that they now deny was commuted. As CNA admitted, they took NNIC's payment, which they're supposed to apply only to commuted contracts, and instead of applying it just to the CCC facultative certificates, the three that the district court held to be commuted, CNA applied a portion of the payment to one CIC facultative certificate. That admission stands in stark contrast to CNA's position and the district court's holding that not a single CIC facultative certificate was commuted. And at a minimum, NNIC, as the non-moving party, was entitled to the inference that CNA had intended to commute that CIC facultative certificate, not just the three. The district court ignored this evidence. And the district court's decision does not mention this admission by CNA of their action in taking part of the commutation payment and applying it to a contract they now say is not commuted. And under this court's decision in Medilex, summary judgment should be reversed where the district court failed to consider evidence that created a reasonable inference in favor of NNIC's position. I want to turn to a second CNA admission that the district court ignored. CNA's signatory to the commutation agreement was Peter Beresford, and CNA's signatory admitted that he reads the commutation agreement to commute all CCC facultative certificates, all of the facultative certificates in the CCC pool, not just the three that CNA maintained below and that the district court held were commuted. And as the record on appeal confirms, there were literally dozens of CCC facultative certificates. And therefore, Mr. Beresford's admission, the signatory to this agreement's admission, is that many CCC, literally dozens of CCC facultative certificates were commuted, not just three. This CNA admission contradicts CNA's position in the district court's holding, but again, the district court did not consider this evidence. And again, the district court's decision does not even mention this inconsistent admission by CNA that more than just those three certificates were commuted. I want to turn to a third CNA admission that the district court ignored, and this pertains to the IBNR figure for facultative balances. IBNR is an estimate of incurred but not reported losses of future exposure, and it exists with treaty reinsurance because of the nature of treaty reinsurance, but you don't typically have IBNR on facultative business because of the nature of the two different types of reinsurance. And CNA's assistant vice president for reinsurance, Vincent Grokachinsky, admitted that CNA would have pegged IBNR on the facultative business that we're talking about here at zero because there would not be enough data on that facultative business to determine frequency and severity necessary to determine IBNR. So CNA's vice president or assistant vice president for reinsurance admits that IBNR would be zero. But contrast this to the district court's holding. One of the four bases, or one of the four factors that the district court cited in holding that all of the facultative certificates could not be commuted was the fact that the district court believed that a reasonable person would not have seen a low IBNR figure for facultative business and assumed that all facultative business was commuted. That district court's erroneous finding is contradicted by CNA's admission, which is not addressed by the district court and not mentioned in the district court's decision. Those three CNA admissions are not the only facts that were ignored by the district court. They were just the ones I want to focus on this morning. There are other facts in the record, and there's documentary evidence in the record that leads to a reasonable inference in support of NNIC's position and that compels reversal of summary judgment. As an example, documents in the record confirm that when NNIC was negotiating this commutation agreement, NNIC looked at both this Continental Casualty, the CCC business, as well as CIC facultative certificates. Evidence in the record confirms that we were looking at the Harbor facultative certificates, and that is a CIC affiliate. Another factor that leads to a reasonable inference in favor of NNIC that the district court overlooked is that our interpretation of the ambiguous language conforms to the custom and practice of the industry. The ambiguous language appears in Schedule A, and Schedule A contains a list of the treaties that were commuted, and then it has that 0709 Bellefont Reinsurance, that internal CNA code under facultatively placed. It's strange credulity to suggest that when CNA drafted Schedule A, that they had time to list 13 treaties that were commuted, but that those three CCC facultative certificates were too numerous to list and that therefore they had to rely on a code for Bellefont Reinsurance. The custom and practice of the industry is when you have many contracts, such as the 2,200 facultative certificates, that you would not list those individually. And instead, Schedule A suggests that all Bellefont assumed facultative certificates were commuted, and that would include the CIC facultative certificates. Additional factors that were overlooked are CNA's own correspondence during the negotiations for the commutation agreement. There's a September 22, 1995 fax to NNIC from CNA in which CNA expressed its interest in commuting balances due CNA. And as the district court held in a 2003 opinion that is not the subject of this appeal, CNA consisted of CCC and CIC at that time. Another factor to consider is that consistent with NNIC's position here, NNIC never paid a claim under any of the facultative certificates that we say are commuted. And in fact, we consistently stated that these facultative certificates were commuted, and we never made a payment of the claim. And I ask you to consider that factor in light of the Whitlock decision of the Illinois Supreme Court. And in that case, what it was at issue in Whitlock, the question was, did a release release the debtor's liability under Loan 1 and Loan 2, or just under Loan 2. The bank had won summary judgment on the fact that the release released the debtor's liability only on Loan 2. And the debtor, though, argued that it covered both Loan 1 and Loan 2. But the problem was the debtor had actually made a payment on Loan 1 after the release. Still, the Supreme Court of Illinois said that summary judgment was not appropriate, and it reversed summary judgment, holding it was improper for the court to speculate on intent and saying that the debtor had the right to present the factual basis to the trier of fact, even though he had made a payment on that loan one that he said was released. And the final point I want to leave the court with this morning is that the ambiguous language which appears on Schedule A is CNA's uncommunicated code. The district court erroneously relied on the fact that CNA used this 0709 Belafonte reinsurance as an internal code only for CCC facultative certificates, but they used it to exclude CIC facultative certificates. Nowhere in the record was that ever communicated. It was never communicated to NNIC, but the fact that 0709 excludes CIC was never communicated, and CNA should not have summary judgment on an uncommunicated meaning of its internal code. And if there are no questions, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Sure, Mr. Trella.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. The issue here, as in any case involving an ambiguous contract, is what did the parties intend? And specifically here, what did they intend in the 1996 commutation agreement? Did they intend to commute the specific contracts that they had spent almost a year discussing and negotiating about, or not only those, but thousands of others that they had never mentioned at any point during the almost year-long discussions? Now, Judge Gettleman correctly concluded that there is no genuine dispute as to any facts material to this question. Every indicator of the party's intent, their discussions at the time, their internal analyses at the time, and their post-contract conduct all point to the same conclusion. They intended to commute and did commute only the contracts that had been listed and itemized in the schedules that they exchanged multiple times during their discussions. Now, the contrary position, the position that Northwestern is arguing for, requires somebody to find that sophisticated parties who engaged in months and months of very detailed and highly document-intensive negotiations about specific contracts, claims, and dollar amounts, nevertheless intended to cover in their agreement thousands of contracts involving companies that they had never discussed, and that for years thereafter they both treated as not having been covered. Now, in Northwestern's briefs, particularly its reply brief and in the argument today, Mr. Smoke points to bits and pieces of evidence that he says supports that conclusion. Neither that evidence nor any other evidence in the record would support a finding by the trial court in a bench trial, and this would be a bench trial, a finding in favor of Northwestern. Now, I think the first fact that he mentioned was the application of the proceeds of the commutation agreement. Now, the evidence concerning what happened is undisputed. The proceeds were first applied to the outstanding balances on Continental Casualty contracts that were listed in the schedules that the parties had exchanged. The excess proceeds were retained for a while, and then they were applied as new claims came up under those contracts. After the existing balances had been fully commuted and the new claims had been dealt with, there was a piece of cash remaining. Now, this is 2 years after the fact. This is in 1998. And at that point, this extra piece of cash was applied against one open CIC contract. Now, there's no dispute that this is what happened, and there's also no dispute in the record that this was consistent with Continental Casualty's normal practice. Northwestern argues, though, that these undisputed facts give rise to some sort of an admission. Now, the logic, as explained here today and also set out in the reply brief, runs like this. According to Northwestern, the 1996 contract required that the proceeds be used only against commuted contracts. Some of the proceeds were applied to the CIC contract, therefore the CIC contract, at least that one, must have been commuted. Now, that logic is simple enough, but it's completely wrong. It fails at its very first premise, the premise that the 1996 agreement requires that the proceeds be used in a particular way. It says nothing at all about how Continental could use the proceeds. Continental Casualty could have taken that money and bought a corporate jet or financed a gambling junket to Las Vegas. Now, the shareholders might have a legitimate complaint, at least about the gambling junket, but Northwestern wouldn't. There's simply not one word in that contract about how the proceeds are to be used. Continental Casualty's only obligation under the contract was not to look to Northwestern to pay any claims on the underlying contracts that had been commuted. What Continental Casualty did with the money and how it accounted for it internally has nothing to do with the contract. So this inference that Northwestern wants to draw rests on a premise that just is non-existent. I think Mr. Smoke then referred to a supposed admission by Peter Beresford, who signed the contract on behalf of Continental Casualty. Mr. Beresford did not admit that the 1996 agreement covered all Continental Casualty facultative certificates. He actually testified that if you focus just on the Belafonte reinsurance entry on Schedule 8 of the agreement, if you view that in isolation, it could be read in that fashion. Well, of course it could. That's why there's an ambiguity in the contract. That's why we're here. But he went on to testify that the agreement as a whole covered and was intended to cover only the listed treaties and the three specific facultative claims. Moreover, even in Northwestern's version, nothing he said has anything to do with the CIC contracts, which is what the heart of the dispute is about. Now, in connection with this supposed admission by Mr. Beresford, Northwestern in its reply brief makes a big deal, and I think it was referenced here this morning, about whether there were or were not more than three outstanding Continental Casualty certificates at the time of the 1996 agreement. Mr. Beresford testified that he wasn't, as a signatory, he was not aware of any, and that's at Exhibit 54 at pages 118 to 19. Now, the internal documents, the internal Northwestern documents that Northwestern cites in its reply, indicate that Northwestern may have issued more than three certificates, but they shed no light on whether they were still outstanding at the relevant time. Moreover, again, it has nothing to do with CIC certificates. It only deals with Continental Casualty. Furthermore, Northwestern's own post-agreement conduct in the way it dealt with the commutation, the way it recorded it and booked it, makes clear that the three listed certificates and the listed treaties are the only ones that it regarded at the time as having been commuted. As we detail in our brief, Northwestern has a very elaborate procedure for dealing with commuted contracts. They take down the reserves, close claim files, put a C marker in the computer system. Northwestern did all of that, but it did it only with respect to listed contracts, not with respect to any CIC contracts or these supposed dozens of others that Mr. Smoke was referring to. The next fact that he pointed to was this IBNR figure. Now, that is a complete non-issue. And in one document during the negotiations, there was a reference to a $7,850 IBNR figure. And that stands, I think, for incurred but not reported or incurred but not recorded. An estimate for the three Continental Casualty facultative certificates. Now, he neglects to point out that Judge Gettleman found that the evidence was undisputed that the final agreement did not include any IBNR for facultative certificates, and that's at page 9 of the appendix. Moreover, Judge Gettleman commented on, sort of contrasted that number, with the reference to thousands of contracts, he was just addressing the speculation by Northwestern that somehow this isolated reference to an IBNR figure meant that the parties clearly intended that these thousands of contracts be commuted. Moreover, the premise of the argument was flawed. The testimony from Vince Gruchaczynski that Northwestern cites about IBNR, it doesn't say that we couldn't compute IBNR for three facultative certificates and therefore it must have covered thousands of others. He really said, under the circumstances here, we couldn't compute IBNR for facultative certificates at all. It's not linked to the cited testimony doesn't link it to the fact that there were three rather than 30 or something like that. It said that IBNR could not be computed for facultative balances at all, and that's at Exhibit 89 at pages 137 to 44. Mr. Smoke also referred to some other facts. He says that the documents indicate that Northwestern looked at CIC certificates during the negotiations. This is a fact reference for the first time in the reply brief, and it refers to some notes that Mr. Dyers, the Northwestern negotiator, apparently made concerning two facultative certificates issued to a CIC company. There's no evidence that the notes had anything to do with the 1996 agreement or the negotiations. No documents exchanged between the parties reference those certificates. Mr. Dyers didn't testify, so there's no direct evidence of what significance the notes had. Northwestern's Ms. Scott, who did the backup work for Mr. Dyers during the negotiations, knew nothing about the notes or the circumstances under which they were created, and in fact specifically testified that she had no recollection that they had anything to do with the 1996 agreement. That's at Exhibit 93, pages 111 to 115. So there's no basis to infer from these notes that Mr. Dyers had CIC in mind when he was negotiating the agreement. And even if he did, one party's understanding, as Northwestern argues elsewhere, that's not communicated to the other side is not material to what the contract means. And Northwestern admitted in the district court, in the memorandum in support of its own motion for summary judgment, at page 8, that there were no communications between the parties concerning CIC or CIC contracts.
Trella, sit here listening to this, both of you. Sounds like you're both trying to draw particular inferences from facts. Why doesn't that make summary judgment simply inappropriate?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think...
Sounds like a jury argument.
Well, I don't think we're drawing any inferences from the facts. What I'm suggesting to you is that, first of all, the non-movement is entitled only to reasonable inferences from the evidence. And just looking at, for example, the subject I was just talking about, these the supposed notes about a CIC contracts, it's a piece of paper with some certificate numbers scribbled on it. One witness said, yeah, that's Jack Dyer's handwriting. That's what we know about it. I would suggest to the court that there's no reasonable inference that can be drawn from that regarding the party's intent. And the same is true of the other evidence that Mr. Smoke referenced. He referenced, for example, a September 1995 fax that refers to, in which Ms. Cornelius, the Continental Casualty negotiator, refers to CNA. And the argument, I guess, is that while CNA included CIC and Continental Casualty, so therefore this agreement must have been intended to include the whole thing. Put to one side the fact that it ignores every other piece of paper that the parties exchanged during months of negotiations. The fact is that this letter was sent after the parties had already been negotiating for months about Continental Casualty. And in fact, this letter is only part of the relevant exhibit. It's the cover letter for an attached set of schedules. In fact, the letter on its face said, attached is a set of schedules reflecting the balances that we're willing to discuss commuting. Now, in the supplemental appendix to Northwestern's reply, they don't include those schedules. They just include the list. But the full exhibit, which is Continental Exhibit 11, and it's in the record, includes those schedules. And all the contracts listed are the Continental Casualty contracts, the ones that eventually ended up being commuted by this agreement. There aren't any CIC contracts. It was crystal clear to the parties what they were talking about. And in fact, I'd refer the court also to Continental Exhibit 14, which is an internal Northwestern analysis from roughly the same time period. And it's headed, CNA commutation discussions or something like that. And again, it lists the same Continental Casualty contracts that everybody knew they were talking about. So this is not this isolated reference to CNA. It's not reasonable to infer that drew in this company that Northwestern admitted nobody had discussed and thousands of contracts that didn't appear in any of the documentation that they were exchanging. Now, one thing that was ignored in Northwestern's briefs and ignored here today is the post-contract conduct of Northwestern. After the 1996 agreement was signed, there were two subsequent attempts to do further commutations, attempts that wouldn't make any sense if the 1996 agreement, in fact, covered everything the way Northwestern argues today that it does. There was an agreement signed in early 2000 to commute the CIC facultative reinsurance that it had assumed from the London Guarantee Association. These are certificates issued by Northwestern to CIC. That was actually successfully concluded. And then later in the year, I believe it was in June, Continental Casualty Mike Valeris contacted Northwestern and said, can we do another commutation to wipe more of the business off the books? In those discussions, Ms. Scott from Northwestern printed out a list of all the open facultative certificates between any CNA company and Northwestern. She produced a list of 2,200 certificates. When Mr. Valeris suggested to her, well, let's focus on 70 of those instead of the whole 2,200, she said, well, I can get you information about the 70, but it would be our intention to commute the entire list, all 2,200. They ultimately weren't able to reach agreement on it because Northwestern could not come up with all the information that CNA needed. But again, the discussions wouldn't have made any sense. They wouldn't have even gone down that road if anybody on either side had thought that 5 years earlier or 4 years earlier, all this had already been taken care of. So I would suggest that if you focus on the material facts here, and first on the issue, which is what did they intend in 1996, and then the indicators of that intent, their discussions with each other, their internal documents, and what were they doing in the years immediately after, it all points in the same direction. And of one final point, Mr. Smoke mentioned that Northwestern never paid any claims. Well, that's sort of why we're here. That's what this litigation is about. It's because CNA didn't get paid on these claims that we're litigating this issue right now. So we submit that summary judgment was proper, and we ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thanks, Joe. Mr. Smoke.
Let me first address, please, the issue of the subsequent commutations. There were two subsequent discussions about commutations between NNIC and between CNA. First, I want to put aside the London Guarantee commutation. That's the one that my adversary referred to as the commutation that was ultimately consummated involving CIC. It was not CIC business. That was London Guarantee Association business. And CIC had apparently purchased a book of business to run off. London Guarantee is not an affiliate of CIC. It's not an affiliate of CCC. It was not covered by the prior commutation. The London Guarantee certificates are totally separate. I want to address the 2000 commutation discussions as well. My adversary told the court that those discussions ended when we weren't able to put together the information on the 2,200 facultative certificates. But that's not correct. As the record confirms, those commutation discussions ended when NNIC told Mike Valeris at CNA that those facultative certificates, those CIC facultative certificates, were covered by the commutation agreement that is at issue today. And those commutation discussions ended when CNA's Mike Valeris agreed with NNIC's position and said that, yes, those 2,200 facultative certificates were commuted by the prior commutation. And NNIC's Teresa Scott sent Mr. Valeris an email, which appears in the supplemental appendix to our reply brief at page 14, confirming their conversation in which they discussed the fact that that the prior commutation included those CIC facultative certificates. If I can just address for a second the explanation for the $6.1 million application of the commutation payment to a CIC facultative certificate that they now say is not commuted. The commutation agreement requires them to apply the commutation payment to commuted balances, and we are entitled to the reasonable inference that when you apply a portion of a commutation payment to a contract, CNA believed that contract was commuted. And that is a reasonable inference, and these are arguments for the trier of fact, and these facts should go to the trier of fact to determine whether or not there's a commutation, and this case is not appropriate for summary judgment. If there are no other questions, we would ask that summary judgment be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Smoke. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under...